Hi, everyone. Welcome to the seventh episode of the Forensic Anthropology Companion Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Kennyhurst. For this episode, I had the chance to sit down with Michaela Spiros.
Hi, my name is Michaela Spiros. I am a third-year biological anthropology PhD student at Michigan State University, specializing in forensic anthropology and researching postcranial variation.
To discuss her paper, Standardization of Postcranial Nonmetric Traits and Their Utility in Ancestry Analysis from Volume 2, Issue Number 1. This type of project is no small feat, and I'm really glad someone is doing it. There's a lot of debate within the field of forensic anthropology about ancestry estimation, and I think Michaela offers a really good perspective on exactly what it is we are estimating. So let's jump in.
I'd like to start off with what got you to studying the nonmetric traits. So what's like your mini biography that got you to where you could write this paper?
This actually all started in my master's program. And the idea of the research came about with Dr. Tony Waldron as my inspiration for the project. He was one of my advisors. And during his paleopathology and morphology course, we talked about a few postcranial variations and the extent that they had been researched, which was primarily clinical literature, and looking at traits in isolation for their incidence or laterality. So in his course, I actually wrote my final paper on a question he posed, which was give an overview of postcranial nonmetric traits and their relevance to bioarchaeological research. And this is kind of where my frustration at the lack of standardization came from with postcranial variations. And at the same time, I was writing an essay for Simon Hilson exploring cranial nonmetric variations and looking at the work that Dr. Joe Hefner's done to standardize the scoring of those traits kind of inspired me to do the same for the postcranial skeleton.
That's awesome. That's fantastic. And it's interesting too that it came from the paleo world first. So what are the three big things about this paper that we need to know about?
Yeah, so I think the primary takeaway from this paper is that there's still an immense amount of information about human variation, especially modern human variation, that we don't know. So continuing research on these variations may help us further understand their utility in biological anthropology. So for this paper, I explore 11 postcranial nonmetric traits in a forensic anthropological framework, focusing on sex ancestry, and I do a little bit of laterality research. But this was a preliminary study, so there's still a lot of work that needs to be done, but that's what research is all about, right? So as I said, this was my master's research at the University College London. And in the UK, master's programs are only one academic year. So it was a quick turnaround. And I was only able to spend about 13 days collecting data in DC, which would not have happened without my friends letting me couch surf between their apartments for 3 weeks. So I guess the main takeaway is that there's still a lot more to do. And then second aspect is that, as we kind of talked about, standardizing data collection is essential for continued research. Again, this was my first project using these traits, but I did use the Terry collection at the Smithsonian Institute, which we know might not necessarily be a direct proxy for modern casework, but setting up this protocol allowed a systematic review of these traits across collections and then in the future across observers and even time. So for example, I've had the opportunity to collect data at the Bass Collection in Tennessee to begin to build this modern database. But even so, the limitations to Black and white Americans show that this expansion of data is necessary and that the protocol can't necessarily be used in isolation as it stands. And then I guess lastly, the postcranial skeleton has been overlooked quite often, with the skull obviously being the key focus in research, which might be due to beliefs in plasticity or how postcranials mainly weight-bearing bones, but maybe the postcranial skeleton is not as plastic as we believe. For example, we see bilateral vastus notches actually in LB1, which is the type specimen of Homo floresiensis, and septal apertures in Homo naledi, humerus fragment, and even in Lucy. So I think there's still a lot of potential there for the postcranium.
Also, I've always wondered why people have neglected the postcranial skeleton just kind of wholesale. And I always just thought it's because it doesn't look cool in photographs, pretty much primarily. One question I did have about these 11 traits is, how did you choose this as a starting point?
Yes. So it was kind of interesting going through. I wanted to, first I searched the literature. The earliest I could find was a trait going back to the mid-1800s. And I wanted to find traits that were not rare, at least in the literature. So I had, I think it was three was my kind of my starting point for any literature researching these traits. So I just basically did a big literature review and took the most common traits that were talked about. And anytime that a trait was said to be rare, I excluded, which maybe those kinds of traits, especially ones that might be biomechanically adapted, like squatting facets, might need to be researched in the future a little bit more. Understanding why and how these traits are coming about is essential before we throw them out from just being insignificant, I guess. But I actually am going to be focusing on socioeconomic status and a really biological or biocultural approach, I guess, for my dissertation. So I think there's a lot that we can kind of delve into there as well.
Oh, yeah. There's so many potential covariates that you could look into that can teach you something meaningful about what it is you're looking at. And then you can then, after you understand and work out the theory, the repercussion, what these mean, then you can apply it to practice confidently.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that, like I said, some of the literature that I looked at did go back to mid-1800s, but the lack of standardization really didn't let me explore those results as much. So it kind of felt like a starting from ground zero, really.
Oh, it certainly does. And it sucks to think about all of that data that was collected that just really can't be used in any meaningful way, which, yeah.
Absolutely.
So that's why standardization is so important, because we need to all be talking about the same thing if we're going to share data and amass larger data sets and ask bigger questions and get better.
Absolutely.
In your introductory paragraph, you have a really good encapsulation of exactly what it is that we might be estimating with ancestry. So could you just walk us through what it is we're estimating?
Yeah, well, simply put, I guess ancestry can be thought of as this proxy for interactions of genetics, environment, culture, and evolutionary processes. But we also know that there's nothing simple about ancestry. Currently, in skeletal biology, we see this non-zero correlation between morphology, ancestry, and social race. And I think I say in the article that it's the forensic anthropologist's job to validate and bolster methodology that estimates an individual's biogeographic ancestry that's in direct relation with the person's genetic history. So we know that social race is not biological, but we see on a genetic level, human populations have these geographically based variations that emerge based on mutations, natural selection, genetic drift. But beyond these evolutionary processes, there's also the fact that we need to explore the embodiment of social inequity. And this can be caused by policies and environment, which in turn influence biology. And these frameworks are essential to informing ancestry research and can influence ideas about future empirical research that is needed to continue to understand modern human variation. I mean, we see it in cranial, dental, postcranial studies for both metric and non-metric methodologies and how they can be used in forensic anthropological casework and biodistance studies.
I think that's a perfect encapsulation of it, because you acknowledge that whatever it is we're estimating, one, isn't real. It's this interaction of things. It's this mysterious other that is just there. And we can utilize that because for time periods or for reasons that might be useful, like the correspondence of social race with some sort of geographic ancestry, that can be exploited by an anthropologist to make a model for classification, which is very helpful. But treating it the way you are describing it or thinking about that way means that it's dynamic, that it changes through time, and our understanding of that has to change through time. Everyone knows that what it means to be a white male in the Terry collection means nothing the same for the Bass collection. So we shouldn't be pulling those as one population or treating it as just one singular thing. That's the best resolution of covariate data we have for that demographic.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, there are so many important discussions going on in the field right now regarding the research and how we can engage with ancestry versus the race dialogue, especially with the public, because I think that's why it's essential to talk about what we are estimating, which are variations in morphology based on a large amount of factors, and that forensic anthropologists in the United States are working in this racialized construct to identify unknown individuals. So I think it's exciting, the research that's going to be coming from these questions.
Me too. I think it's going to drive the field into a much better place, a much more theory-bound place, as opposed to just pulling out using methods because they quote unquote work. Instead, use them because you know what,
right, absolutely,
what that means. Yeah.
Science is all about hypothesizing and testing and continuing to expand research. So I think a big thing, especially with the call for equity and methodology in general, stems for the need for further research. And we see that even in stature and sex estimation methods with population-specific methods working better than none. So I think a lot of good will be coming out of this in the future.
Yeah, I think too. It's a little bit turbulent and there's a lot of very vocal opinions for all the right reasons. But I think as scientists, we have a better way of communicating, and that's through testing our ideas. And the bulk of my disagreement is with the way in which these discussions are being couched instead of tested.
Yeah. I mean, I think it all just going to lead to better research. I know an interview of Dr. Elizabeth DeGangi came out today where she makes a great point that research has never determined the extent to which these features are inherited. And we see like a perfect example of how we can continue to rectify this is actually at Michigan State, Amber Plemons. Her current research is on the influence of genetics and climate on cranial morphology. So look at the outcomes of these aspects through secular change, for example, with so many dependent variables like climate, SES, biomechanics. We take those into consideration as well and really see how they can influence biology. I think we're going to be asking a lot more scientific questions and doing more empirical studies on what and why these variations are occurring. And I think it'll be exciting to see what happens.
Yeah, I think so too. And whenever the meetings can be real again, I think there'll be very productive discussions that we can have in person that you just can't really do through the computer so much.
Definitely. Absolutely.
What was the most unexpectedly difficult aspect of developing your own trait list or framework, or something that may have been unexpected that just kind of sucked?
Yeah, honestly, access to literature. Shelley Saunders wrote a dissertation on postcranial nonmetric traits, which was so applicable to my research, but I couldn't get my hands on it until after I'd already created my protocol and collected the data. So luckily, I finally got access to it before I started writing my thesis, but having it in hand before would have been extremely helpful. And I guess also illustrating the line drawings. I didn't have access to any sort of image editor, so those are my hand drawings. I'm not an artist. So I've since updated the illustrations actually on ResearchGate, but I definitely would have loved to have access to Photoshop at the time.
That's wild. You did that by hand?
Yeah, and it was not fun.
I can't imagine. I can only draw stick figures. I thought those were computer generated. I was like, oh, those are pretty good. So it's funny what you think is bad, what I think is great.
Well, thank you.
I love that at the beginning of each of your trait definitions, you give like a really concise history showing like where it came from, the original authors, all that stuff. That is super important because it adds this level of like epistemology to what we're doing. It allows you to trace this back to its original source. Did you find anything surprising while looking back at some of these traits that you were like, that's weird?
Yeah, so the trait history came, again, from a lack of literature. So it was for my own sanity that this history came about. Like I said, I came up with this research idea with the help of Dr. Tony Waldron. And I was going into the different variations and the extent to which they had been researched. And the clinical literature helped a lot. So I think the biggest thing that surprised me was how far back some of the traits had been researched. Again, like the septal aperture in 1885, and how much clinical research had already delved into these traits. But also how, even though there was so little research, the two seminal pieces investigating the combination of the multiple postcranial traits, the one by Dr. Shelley Saunders and the other one by Dr. Michael Finnegan, were both written in 1978. So that was really interesting to see how those kind of came about the same year after long-term, I guess, missing literature for quite a while.
Yeah, 78 was a good year for postcranial nonmetrics and then nothing else.
Right. Yep. Exactly.
But it's interesting because it's only what, in a few years, that Howells will release his craniometrics in man or whatever. Maybe that could be a reason why the field kind of went towards just skulls in general, because now they have this big database with which they compare to, whereas everything else was kind of smaller scale. All right. So when talking about the traits on the trait list, are there any suggestions you might have for any of the traits for scoring? Anything that you thought was difficult or that you think people might have a hard time with? Just anything that might help people utilize this in their own work?
Well, two confusing traits, according to the really small inter-observer error test I was able to do, included the vastus notch and posterior bridging of the atlas. And I think the vastus notch can be tricky in a similar way that post-bragmatic depression can be in the cranium. I score it as present regardless of size of the notch, and size can range immensely. It can look like a small crescent-shaped contour in the superior lateral aspect of the patella, or it can look like the entire superior lateral aspect has been removed. So if someone sees a large vastus notch and then a small one, they may be more inclined to score the small one as absent, even though it's still there.
Interesting.
Okay. And then I guess for bridging of the atlas, in the same way that the suprascapular framing can be tough, observers might be confused by partial bridging. I didn't score partial bridging for the scapula or the atlas, which I think should be explored further. But for now, it's either absent or present. And so that might be tricky for users as well.
So we kind of talked about, was there anything interesting about the history that you found? What about in just all of this, like amassing your data set, anything else that was difficult or unexpectedly difficult, or things that you wish you would have thought of at the beginning that would have helped later?
I think that the lack of standardization and terminology across the literature was most surprising, but I guess I really shouldn't have thought that, seeing anatomical literature in general. But the most interesting part was other forensic anthropologists' implicit bias to hear non-metric and immediately think cranial. Originally, I used infracranial to describe these variations, trying to stick with the terminology by Saunders and Finnegan. But you would be amazed how many researchers heard intracranial and immediately were confused. So now that I have combined the protocol of collecting these traits with cranial macromorphoscopic variations in my next publication, I went and changed the terminology again to postcranial macromorphoscopic traits and did the very thing that annoyed me from the beginning.
That's so funny. I've only met one person that uses infracranial. I don't disagree with the reason. It's not posterior to us anymore since we're on two legs. I get it. It's inferior, but right. Yeah, I don't know.
That one letter though, intra versus infra, it trips people up.
Yeah, and English is hard enough to begin with. So what is something that's important about this research that you think might get missed?
I think that it is a protocol, and in this article specifically, it's not a method as it stands. Like I said, I've since expanded it to combine postcranial and cranial macromorphoscopic variations for analysis and created a Shiny app combo MAMD analytical for this use. But I think the original paper, people are looking to use it for ancestry estimation, but this is just a framework for the protocol and exploring the relationships with chi-square analyses and correspondence analyses. So I think that's something that might get missed in this first publication.
If you could look back and start all over again, is there anything you would have done differently?
First and foremost, creating a digital data recording system beforehand would have been great. I was very nervous about internet access at the Terry collection, and with my anxiety, I collected all of my data on paper and then typed them into an Excel sheet each day, which was definitely tedious. But I've since created a Shiny app to collect my data, but it still needs a lot of work.
It's becoming more pervasive in our field, and I love it. I absolutely love it. I think everyone should learn how to use it. The learning curve is a little bit steep if you're not familiar with programming, but if you are familiar with pretty much any language, you can pick it up pretty quick, and you can do a lot of really phenomenal things that makes our work easier. For you, making one just for data collection is a great idea for data consistency, usability, and just saving yourself hours of worrying about transcription errors and hating yourself and paper cuts.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. For the original data collection on those paper sheets, I was terrified every day going back and forth. I'm like, I need to type these in right now. I need to make sure that they are done correctly, scan them into my computer, have them saved in multiple places. So yes, this has definitely been easier.
That's amazing. How did you get involved with Shiny? Did you start taking courses? Have you always been into programming?
No, I actually got into Shiny through the last paper I wrote for CombomMD Analytical and really just learned from bottom up. For that paper, I had already worked in R and had that experience, but even that was at the time just learning kind of from the beginning, the basics. And luckily there are plenty of tutorials online to help kind of go through each individual step. So that's been really helpful. And working with Joe has been great because he is a whiz at R and can really help answer any questions I had.
That's phenomenal. And you picked it up so much faster than I did. I started learning R in 2009. And it took me, when did I come out with Human ID? 2018? 2017. It took me 8 years.
I mean, yeah, 8 years. I mean, I do think if I didn't have a hard deadline, that definitely would have been the case. But at that point, I was just trying to do whatever I can to get it out there. So
that's wild.
But it is, the learning curve is steep.
Learning curve is steep, but also the mindset to even want to undertake doing that is exceedingly rare. Now, there's going to be a huge change, I think, in our discipline coming up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we already talked about all the different factors that come into play for ancestry alone, and that doesn't give you a one-to-one ratio of what's happening. So understanding the logistics of the statistics and the evolutionary processes and everything that's happening, really just looking at the context is essential.
Yeah, and training your brain to think that's not the end. That answer isn't the end. That answer is more information, which reduces our uncertainty, which is good, but that's not it. We can't just abandon this practice that easily. That's all of the main questions I have, except for what's coming up next. Is there anything you want to just talk about or promote or say, whatever? I mean, it's carte blanche, whatever you want to talk about.
Yeah. So I think right now the focus is really empirically exploring these traits and really the morphological changes in the skeleton. So for my dissertation, I am focusing on the ontogeny and further distribution of these variations and really taking a biocultural approach, exploring age and ancestry relationship under this theoretical umbrella of developmental plasticity, socioeconomic status, things that all can contribute to the genetic underpinnings of the trait. Evolutionary history is obviously so important in any human variation research, but we need to think of these future research questions with that evolutionary background connected to genomic research. And any ancestry research especially should be couched in that biocultural approach, which I know Dr. Maroon Palud talked about in the fourth episode of the podcast. But going forth, we also need to be collaborating, bringing together a variety of methods to increase accuracy and improve these finer resolution results. So looking at one area of the skeleton really limits research and practical application, especially if you're working with fragmentary remains, whether it's from a fatal fire incident in forensic context or bioarchaeological context. So the more insights we can have, the better chance we'll have to identify an individual or answer research questions.
If there's any students or researchers out there that want to get involved in this type of research, that wants to use kind of the standardizations that you've put out, is there, or maybe they've already collected this data, do you want like people to give you stuff? I'm trying to think of like, how can you spin this to be useful for you? Like, do you want, maybe people have data that they give you, who knows, I don't know. So I'm trying to stimulate ideas for upcoming students that might want to look at something somehow. And this is a really good starting point that maybe you can then get their data from them.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we talked about collaboration, which I am all for. I think it's the best way to have science continue and really get to the points that we all want to answer. So I mean, there's postcranial metric research that's being done, and there's a lot of different morphological studies on specific bones in the postcranial skeleton. So I think the biggest thing is, if anybody is researching really any kind of human variation, that they can be combined with this method, or this method could be expanded. Like I said, I only looked at 11 traits, but who knows, again, what squatting facets mean, if it really is just biomechanically induced. So any sort of question related, I think, would be the key.
Thank you to Michaela Spiros, and thank you for listening as well. I really enjoyed this chat, and I hope you found something useful too. We'll be back again soonish with a chat with Dr. Chris Meyer to discuss his paper, Evaluating Mixed Methods Models for the Estimation of Ancestry from Skeletal Remains. Be good.